is the British Tech Network comic show. We are up to episode, oh gosh, which episode are we up to, gentlemen? Is it 12?
We're 11. On issue 11. 11. Issue. 11. Issue, not episode.
We, I'm sorry. Hello and welcome to issue 11 of the British Tech Network comic podcast. We are down a host this evening, and so we have an actual honest-to-goodness comic artist who is joining us today for some interesting chat and insight. We're super, super pumped. And as you probably don't know, but are about to find out, he's going to hold a special place in our hearts as our first ever official comic show guest. So this is a very special issue of the comic podcast. This would be the one with a foil variant. Because that's where we're taking it. So with me tonight, I have two of the usual suspects. Also in a similar time zone to Kelly, we have the lovely Jeff Gamet.
And it's so much fun to always be here, especially with the lovely Kelly Gumont. And I just realized almost all of us on the show this week are on the American continent.
That's very, very true. Yeah. So let's go ahead and introduce the odd man out. We have Paul Kirkle with us.
Why am I always the odd man out? It doesn't matter how many Brits are on the thing. I'm the odd man out. Hello, Kelly. You all right?
Yes. And how are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. I'm chilling out after a long day. And it's just 9 o'clock, 9 p.m., just getting past my bedtime. But I am so excited about this issue. So, yeah,
yes.
Let's go.
So let's get down to it. Sadly, tonight we are unable to be joined by Andy, a.k.a. Dr. Happy Mac, who's usually our host-type person, which might be why you're listening to the show and wondering why you're hearing me. Right off the top, anyway, I usually give him a minute or two before I start talking all over him. And tonight we have with us the fantastic Archaea-published Mouse Guard author, David Peterson.
Hello.
And David's coming to us from Michigan, which is why we were teasing Paul for being the odd man out, because 75% of the panel this week is in North America. So let's get to David. David, why do people, I know my intro sort of gave it away, but why do people know you?
Because of Mouse Guard, pretty much. It's the book that that I've been doing since 2005, technically. It came out through Archaea in 2006.
Thank you. Bless you.
It's a book about mice with swords, medieval mice with swords.
Mm. And sometimes cloaks.
And they were cloaks. They were
often
cloaks.
A beer.
That's my really short elevator pitch. I don't like
You can go ahead and unplug the power strip. It's not going to hurt anything. Yeah.
Kelly, you still on?
I totally switched the switch the wrong way. I thought I was muted, and I wasn't muted. I apologize.
That's all right. See, this is what happens when you get people that are all in the middle of the technology. We can't tell the difference between a mute switch and,
lots of buttons.
And a not mute switch.
No, I just had inadvertently flipped it. So I was like, oh, let me just flip this, and then I'll be plugged in. So let me point out that this is a beautifully illustrated book about mice with swords and occasionally cloaks, because it really, really is gorgeous. If you're, this is one, if we haven't, I believe it's one we're going to suggest for our What Should Alex Read segment, because when you look at it, it would not be art that I would automatically associate with being a comic title.
Mm. Well, thank you.
So I will just put that out there. Like, you know, it's not, and that's not to say it's not great, because I think it's wonderful, wonderful art. But when you think of a comic book or a particular comic title or a graphic novel, you sort of think of the art being a particular way. And this is very different from most of the sort of thick black line action hero stuff that you see. And it's beautifully illustrated. It's very lush would be the word that I would use. And I'm going to let Paul use actual official arty words to describe it, because all I can do is say, gosh, but that's pretty. So,
yeah, but gosh, that's pretty really does it justice.
I was going to say, that's got to be on the back of Legends too, surely. As one of the quotes.
I will try to find a place for that pull quote.
Right, now, Kelly, I've got to ask you a question, which is, have you seen the new section of the Google Doc for this issue? I'm intrigued.
that's probably going to be a no. So.
Because the top three news things for this week...
Oh, no.
All involve your favorite person in the whole world.
Oh, really?
So, David, you missed out on last week. There was a 25-minute soliloquy.
I believe that was where, after edits.
Oh, blimey, really, Philip? So we had a very quick and gentle chat about the role of a female audience in comic books, because that had come up in the news from Mark Miller and Todd McFarlane. And it's just really interesting that the news this week all feels like it's coming out of... It feels like it's been the news as ordained by Millerworld.
It's as if the world is begging for Kelly to rant.
Oh, yeah, blimey.
And, you know, it kind of is, because I do a tech podcast called Angry Mac Bastards, and this week we did an entire hour on Dave Weiner shoots off his fool mouth again about ladies and programming.
Oh, actually, it's been a good week for that, hasn't it? With Marissa Meyer on the front cover of Vogue as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, don't get... No, whoa.
No, I'm not sidelining it, but I'm just saying. It's like... It is... It really... It's like the whole universe is conspiring to get me to put the ranty pants on. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But they fit you so well.
They're super cute, and they're so on trend. So I vote we just start with the top of the news, because I'm very interested in what you guys are going to think of this.
Well, top of the news, I know we said in issue one that we're going to try not to talk about movies as much as possible.
Sure.
But Mark Miller, and various producers have talked about the fact that non-Marvel comics, Marvel film comics... Fantastic Four, X-Men, and so on, are going to also exist in a shared universe. So presumably Spider-Man as well, possibly, even though we're then getting into different movie companies.
Yes.
But it interested me, is in the same way that DC... Right, and this is going to all start becoming very cynical in a way, but in the same way that everybody looked at the press release for Superman and Batman and went, oh, no, just come on, and Justice League, and no, you don't have to redo the Avengers and just change the pointy ears. Is FF and X-Men, is there a good thing about them sharing a universe, or is there a bad thing?
I think it's fantastic.
I think it's a double-edged sword. This is because the thing about it is that so far, in my estimation, the Fantastic Four movies have been crap. So this can only be good news for Fantastic Four movies. I feel like by the same token, it could possibly mean that now X-Men movies are going to be less awesome. Now we've already seen that the third X-Men film was less awesome. But I really thought that First Class was great. I did I know my brother comes up a lot, and my brother went and saw the Wolverine, went and saw that, and he said, and his official review was, "Oh well, at least Thor 2 is coming soon." So what I love about what Marvel has done so far, the thing that makes me very happy about it, is the way that they sort of had the Easter egg of the next film, almost Pixar style, where, you know, there's the Flash and the thing that drops out of the sky and in the Incredible Hulk, and that was Thor. And, you know, and then the next thing, and then the next thing, and, like, there's this sly, sort of clever reference to Tony Stark in one of the other movies, and how all of that just really made it feel like a shared universe. And I think if they can do something like that, where it's a casual thing and it's not even necessarily fan service stuff, you know, but it's the little reference like in the first X-Men movie when Wolverine makes fun of the uniforms and Cyclops says, "What'd you expect, blue and yellow spandex?" You know, when you can make the, when you can add those little touches for people who are paying attention and understand what's going on, but you're not taking away from the rest of the universe, I think it's great. So this is one of those, it could be awesome, but things like this have gone so terribly wrong before, I'm just a little nervous about it.
Now, I have to trust Marvel on stuff like this, because they have done a really good job with making Avengers. The Avengers franchise fit with the other character franchises that they have.
Yes.
And one of the big, big problems that I had with the various Marvel movies, and especially with the Avengers, was that we know there's a shared universe because we've already seen characters crossing over. And if nothing else, we see them crossing over into the same locations. So when we have the Avengers movie and we have a massive alien invasion and we have only the Avengers there, the first thought I had was, where are the X-Men? This is where the Fantastic Four lives. Why are they not here? Spider-Man yeah. lives in this town. Why is he not here? And I'm totally showing nerd cred right now because these are the things that I was thinking about as we're coming into the big epic fight scene.
And, right.
And you can't conveniently say, well, Spider-Man was busy fighting in another part of town and the Fantastic Four happened to be in another dimension at the time and the X-Men were off dealing with Magneto in Japan or something like that. You can't have everyone gone at the same time.
I tell you what, it would have been a lovely scene, though, if they'd had Spider-Man dressed as Peter Parker, just about to put the mask on, and then the little guy in The Incredibles going up there as the lawyer and saying, Well, you cannot help. You are contractually obliged not to help the Avengers. So, David, do you have a feeling about the comic book film adaptations? A like, a hate? Do you have one that you've really thought has got it right?
I think the shared universe thing for Marvel has worked because the characters, the individual character movies that they chose to then kind of bridge together already worked together in the Avengers. Like that, there was a comic where those specific people already teamed up. So bringing them together made sense. Sharing beyond that, I think, is a really dangerous thing. And actually, for the reason that Jeff brought up, if you have a minor alien invasion that's a big enough plot point for, you know, one team to handle and everybody shows up, the conflict is over in a second and it's boring. Mm. It's just so you almost have to limit the scope so that you can have these more intimate fights, more intimate confrontations. In the comic universe, I felt like some of the universe stuff is actually what has led to some of the problems of mainstream comics, and that once they start crossing over, readers have to buy more books than they regularly wanted to. You come up with plot holes, and you come up with these kind of never-ending and homogenized stories. I see the Fantastic Four as being really kooky. It's a weird premise. Their superpowers for the most part are pretty funky. They're not, you know, your standard, I guess all superpowers are kind of funky, but I just always
this
thought
this particular
it being,
combination is.
Yeah. I just saw the Fantastic Four as being kind of goofy. And then when you think about the kind of villains they tend to fight and situations they get into, it's almost Sid and Marty Croft kind of thing. Like, it's just bizarre. They've got a flying car. They go into space. They're mostly a family. You know, there's a rock dude. The other guy stretches. They're fighting shape-shifting aliens, but also mole men. And it's like they're silly villains. And I would love to see a Fantastic Four movie that was that silly. Wacky, that really embraced it. Kind of the way the First Class said, okay, let's do a period piece. I want to see something funky for Fantastic Four. And if you start bringing Fantastic Four into what First Class is now, you're definitely making it serious. Everything has to be serious. Everything has to be the same kind of homogenized flavor.
Yeah.
And I think the one that's going to tell us the most is Guardians of the Galaxy. Because that is also a kind of silly, wacky, fun premise. It's not your standard superhero book. And from what I've seen of the way they're marketing it with that little teaser trailer, that's what they're going for. It's going to be
fun
and goofy. But at the same time, it's going to share the Disney Marvel movie franchise. So if some of these companies are willing to have very different things then come together in terms of mood and cinematic style, then I think it could be fine. But I would rather see the individual movies be more more story and genre and mood and atmosphere specific and character specific.
Yeah. As soon as you said all that, the first thing that sprung to mind was, I would love to see Pixar do the Fantastic Four. Because The Incredibles was so good.
Yeah.
And it is a genre masterpiece. And they did Wacky and Goofy and Silly Powers and the fun of the family, which is what Fantastic Four is.
And the emotion.
Well, if you look at what The Incredibles is, they basically are the Fantastic Four.
It is the Fantastic Four to an extent, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, they just replaced fire with running fast.
Mm.
But
yeah.
You have the stretchy person, you have the super strong person, you have the person that can be invisible and make energy shields, and then you have, in this case, the running guy instead of the fire guy.
Yeah.
But then they even have the fire guy by the end of that.
But The Incredibles is a love letter to comics.
Oh, it absolutely is.
And the Fantastic Four being, you know, the oldest, I can't remember what they're called, and Marvel give it so many different names above the masthead sometimes. But there is something that is like a foundation to comics that is the Fantastic Four in so many ways. But I tell you what, Fantastic Four, when I think of them, I think of what is the best comics bad guy, full flat stop, which is Galactus. I love Galactus.
So
he is
good.
And it's brilliant because I entirely agree with David about everything about them being goofy. And Galactus is goofy. But he is galactically goofy. He is he is brilliantly silly and the most thunderously fabulous bad guy in all of comics.
Well, and when you look at his sidekick, a silver guy on a surfboard.
Yeah, I was going to say I love him as well, actually. But there you go.
I always thought he was really scary.
Galactus or Silver Surfer?
The Silver Surfer. Because like,
why'd you think
he doesn't? Yeah. Because he doesn't really have a face, and it's not like. He's a big monologuer, so you know it's not like he goes on at length. So it's just mostly that he's very mysterious. But because he's A, mysterious, and B, you know, buddies with Galactus, like it just feels like there's a whole lot more happening there. You know, because it's not like he talks about it the whole time. So it's sort of like it's kind of like Boba Fett after Empire Strikes Back. You saw a little bit of Boba Fett, and you know he was. Pretty much a badass, but then like, you know, but you didn't know much about him, which is part of what made him cool, but you kind of knew he was more or less a bad guy. And it's the same sort of thing with the Silver Surfer, but the Silver Surfer has been around for so much longer and you still don't know anything about him. So I think to me, that's why he was sort of a scarier dude. Cause you just don't know what he's capable of.
Cool. Cool. So the next two bits of news, again, Miller related, Kick-Ass 2 opens to not big numbers.
Well, not big compared to The Butler, but it beat the pants off Jobs.
Okay. Listen.
That's another show, Jeff.
Jobs.
Oh, I mean,
that's
that's
like a comic book movie without any ink, any panels, anything. And also, in the UK, we've got a anthology comic that Mark Miller sort of like was very instrumental in setting up called Clint. Now, I don't know. So if I say the word Clint in association with comics, and I'm going to have to very delicately skirt around the reasoning, but do you know why he called it Clint?
I don't know.
Since you feel like you have to skirt around the issue, I'm assuming skirt is an operative word here.
It's sort of like in the sort of geographical area. Well, basically what happened was in the... olden days with comics in the UK, it was all printed on toilet roll, more or less. You know, very runny paper that you put ink in, it would bleed all over the place.
Yeah.
So any artist, any writer could write or draw for 2000 AD, but if their name was Clint, they were not allowed to be called Clint on page in case the ink ran and you got a letter that you didn't want. Oh, you got a word that you didn't want in a family-esque comic where people are being shot through the... Exactly. So, anyway, Clint has shut down this month. And it interested me because Clint was like 2000 AD, but with sex, drugs, and even more violence. And it was the UK, the launch pad for a lot of artists, but in the grim and gritty and, you know, TNA shelf, if that makes sense. They had issues with, because nothing's behind the counter anymore, is it? I mean, it's just on a shelf just above the comics, really. But,
yeah, I guess that's true.
What does that tell us about comics at the moment? Because violence has never been an issue for comics, in as much as it's an issue, but it's never been a known issue. But we've just had Clint shut down. Kick-Ass, which is just all about violence, Hollywood-esque violence, has not opened to a great deal. I don't think Kick-Ass 1 opened to great numbers. It was DVD The Rescue did, from my understanding.
It didn't.
Right. Yeah, it became a cult classic after it went to DVD.
So what is that saying about violent comics? Is it something that gains a very loyal audience? Or is it something where actually there's enough violence in comics? We want something that isn't violence plus boobies.
I think it says a lot about the storylines.
Yeah, you have to tell a good story. Let me just point out in the Wikipedia entry for the comic that it says, Miller's The Secret Service, which began in the second volume, features art from Dave Gibbons.
Yes.
On August 14th, 2013, Titan announced the magazine was ending.
Careful.
I'm just going to put that out there for the...
No, there's nothing in there at all.
No, not a bit. What I did think was interesting about this was in looking it up that this monthly magazine included comics that were written by Jonathan Ross and Jimmy Carr.
Yep. So no big names in the UK. So, and they still didn't draw people in, ho-ho, pun unintended.
They still couldn't get people.
Yeah.
I think it's probably twofold. I think it's probably partly that... I know about Kick-Ass, and I know, you know, like the vague plot line. I know that Hit Girl was like a spin-off series from Kick-Ass. So, like, I'm sort of familiar with it. I haven't sat down and read them, and I certainly haven't bought any. But I think maybe it's just that the kind of story that grabs people's attention, like, if it's going to jump up and grab people's attention for that kind of violence, you can really only do that once, because then you get... Then people are like, oh, I've seen this, you know. Mm. I saw when he wrote this story and it was called Kick-Ass or it was called Hit Girl. Mm. So I think that's one piece. And then I think the second piece of it is probably has to do with our first story, which is comic book movies. And I think a lot of people are experiencing the same sort of halo effect that we see sometimes with technology, where somebody went and saw the Avengers and went, this is really great. Maybe I should check out the comic. I know... You know, the kids are all saying that this was a comic title, so maybe I should go read some of these comics. It's going to be a while before they make another film. And that's how you get people interested in things like Hawkeye or back issues of the Avengers and some of the big crossover stuff that got collected. Mm. You know, so it's probably people who are used to some of that stuff, which is not a similar style to anything that Mark Miller has ever done ever.
So, I mean, this is the other interesting thing.
You know, people wanting something more Fantastic Four-like and getting Kick-Ass, like,
yeah.
It's going to be a bit of a shock. And I think it might be something that, you know, if somebody picks it up and flips through it, it's not like a DVD where you can kind of casually flip through a DVD and go, oh, this movie is totally for me. You have to wait till you get home and get the shrink wrap off. And that's not a case with a comic book. So people are probably flipping through it and going... I can't imagine what the budget is for red ink on this title and putting it back on the shelf.
Mm-hmm. You know, then you have the problem with products like Wanted, which I think was a great graphic novel series. Horrible movie. And if people looked at that movie and thought, oh, I should go read the comic, they were in for a very big surprise because they were the same pretty much only in name. And Wanted was a really bad movie, so I'm sure it turned a lot of people off to the comic before they even had a chance to check it out.
Right.
Yeah.
And Avengers has the opposite problem, and then, you know, people pick up Avengers comics, and while they're in the comic book store, they go, oh, what about, maybe I should try this, maybe I should try that, and flip through it and go, nah. Or like we've talked about before, coming in on the middle of something.
Yeah. Which is the hardest thing. You know, if you're telling a sequential story over months, when do you jump on? It's a hard thing to judge.
All right, I think the other big news thing we should hit this week Mouse Guard is number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list.
Is it not? Well, it's on there for the third week in a row, which was the news story. I love that.
It's on there for the third week in a row. Wow. Sorry, David. I totally screwed up explaining how awesome your book is.
It's number 4. I was going to say, did something happen? I thought it was number 4. It moved up a slot, but I'm totally cool.
In my fantasy carefully, world, it moved up a slot, apparently.
Yeah, when this goes onto the internet, it will be number 3.
Yeah.
Jeff will be vindicated.
I certainly hope so.
How does that feel, though, to be on the New York Times bestsellers?
It's surreal enough that I don't even know how to explain it. It just doesn't even make sense.
How did you hear? It got published. It went out to all the bookshops mm-hmm. and the comic bookshops. Does it take into account digital downloads as well?
I really don't know. My second Mouse Guard book also made the New York Times bestseller list for a while.
And that wouldn't have had any downloads at all.
That one, might have had some digital. I don't know if they would have included it.
It came much, much later. I seem to remember, because I had both the hardbacks. I seem to remember it was a lot later that they came onto the digital. Okay. I think. But
that could be.
Did somebody phone you?
With the second one, I got a phone call from Arkea. Mm. With this one, it was a tweet, and I think it was somebody else who tweeted it, and Arkea retweeted it, so it ended up on my on my feed. But I was
so you got a retweet and not a fruit basket. Right. Needs to talk to Arkea.
Yeah, we got to sort this out.
I need no fruit basket. I need no fruit basket. I finished Black Axe a while ago, and that's obviously already in print. And then the second Legends of the Guard volume, I had just finished. Everything that I needed to get done for that, done, and off to Arkea at some ungodly AM hour. And then the next day, my wife and I left to go to the other side of Michigan for a family vacation for probably I think it was 13 days. And it was going to be the first break I've had not having a deadline over my head in 8 years. Mm. And so, yeah, that's where I was. I was on the beach of Lake Michigan, and I saw a tweet from Arkea, and it said something about New York Times bestseller. And it was like, what? What is this? So I looked into it, and, yeah, that's the details. I know that the specifics on how they get their data is fuzzy. Mm. That it's a combination of getting actual sales numbers, but also talking to retailers and talking to bookshops and taking a sampling of some other things. And it's fuzzy enough. I have no clue how it's done, but happy to be there.
Mm. Oh, blimey. Mm. Well, I tell you what, as much as anything else, I'm happy that you're representing comics on the New York Times bestseller list, because there have been some amazing comics on the list as well in the past, but there have been some that were less good comics necessarily. So to look at the list, I don't know where they have them, whether a bookshop would have them all stacked up one against the other, but it's going to be the prettiest one on that list.
Oh, hands down. I would also like to point out for those, for our longtime fans, that when you go to Arkea's website and you look at the page that they have up for Mouse Guard, it tells you what Mouse Guard is about. And this was something that really chapped me a few issues back, that I was trying to find out about comics that other people had recommended, when we're on the show and I go look up titles later, and I can't find out what the whole thing is about. I can find out a little bit about the current issue, but sure, I can't find out anything about the overall title. It's four people in blue and white suits, two of whom are married, and they all have goofy superpowers and adventure. And I can't even find that as a description anywhere, from Marvel. And so to be on Arkea's website and see that it tells me something about what the whole overall title actually is involving, and it makes me really, really happy, because it was something I was looking. I was like, Marvel doesn't do this. DC doesn't do this. And they're the two biggest. And so others, are sort of feeling like it's okay and getting away with it. And it was making me very unhappy. So I already have enjoyed a fair share of Mouse Guard, but I just want to point out that Arkea is totally doing this properly, so that as people discover you on the New York Times bestseller list, they're able to come here and find out a little more about what they're actually in for with the comic. And that makes me very happy.
Thank you. I think, you know, I've certainly realized this, and I think Arkea is fully behind this, but Mouse Guard is a true all-ages comics, which means it's not just for kids. It's also for adults. And as much as I kind of will assume after being in the same city over and over for conventions, and not like San Diego where, you know, obviously bringing in people from all over the world to San Diego, but something like the Baltimore Comic Convention or something like that. Like, yes, people come in from out of town, but for the most part, it's a lot of the same crowd every year. And so there were a couple of years where I didn't have a new book out or, you know, whatever. And I'd go there and I'd think, man, I've probably already saturated my market to the maximum point that I could. And I'll still have 20% of people coming up saying, tell me about Mouse Guard. What is this about? Or they'll even say, like, I wish I had known about you last year, or I wish you were here last year. And I'd say, well, I was. And they're like, no. I go, yeah, I was. I was sitting right here, actually. Really, with Mouse Guard. Yeah. So what that means is that I haven't saturated the market. Mouse Guard, I think, has a broad enough appeal that people are constantly looking. And because it's one of those kind of comics that you don't have to be a comic book person to read, it's not that kind of intimidating, like getting in on the middle of, you know, Flash number 163 for your non-comic reader. They look at that and go, yeah, I'm not going to pick this up. But Mouse Guard's much more accessible to the new reader. We're very aware that we have to make sure that we don't take that for granted, that the story is accessible to new readers, but actually be accessible to new readers. So always have first volume in print, being able to, like I did at the very beginning, very, very quickly explain what Mouse Guard is, and then only go into more detail if they're really showing interest, if they want to know more.
The lovely thing about the first one is you don't explain things that don't need to be explained. The world is there, full stop. I'm not explaining more about how these mouse started talking to each other or anything like that. It is a world that exists, de facto, deal with it. I'll tell you about the story bits, but I love the fact that you walk into a living, breathing world and it's there. Come and join in.
And that's really great because I really, you know, like if you want to go get into Origin Universe world building stuff, like you can do that and that's fine. But I don't feel like it's necessary to the plot most of the time. And like in this case, it totally isn't. You just sort of walk in and go, okay, this is where we are, and off you go. And it's great. And thank you for hitting the nail on the head with what it is about it that appeals to me so much, which is that it's a family book in that it is something that is built for kids and built for adults and not just what has become the definition of family entertainment, which is something for kids that might possibly be something an adult can tolerate.
Yeah, that a parent can tolerate or that has some fart jokes for the parents that just go over the heads of the kids. Mm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of stuff, that kind of family entertainment stuff really irritates me. You know, and then the stuff about making Mouse Guard, like that I jumped into the story and I didn't over explain the exposition or anything like that. Some of that just grew out of me never having done a comic before Mouse Guard. I mean, I had drawn maybe 10 pages of something. I'd come up with probably 20 different comic ideas from I was like 14 up until I started Mouse Guard. I mean, like, full universe kind of, you know, story. Not just like, oh, maybe I'll do a story about blah, blah, blah. But, like, characters and character sheets and all kinds of stuff. And I only ever got about 10 pages in. And I also did a lot of role-playing, like Dungeons & Dragons and Shadowrun and stuff like that. And I know from friends who created adventures and trying to create my own adventures, it's really easy to get so wrapped up in the world-building stuff, you never get to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so with Mouse Guard, I thought this is like I have a lot of world building stuff that I've thought of for what I know that this world is, and it'd be fun to explore. But I need to explain the premise of talking mice with swords and what they do as quickly as possible, so that someone's gonna get into this without belaboring it, because it's a really you know, at the time, you know, there have been other Mouse books, and there's been more all-ages content since Mouse Guard has come out. Mm. I'm saying I'm taking credit for it. I'm saying I think the general climate is changing in some degree. But at the time that I was doing Mouse Guard, that wasn't entirely the case, and I needed to be able to get you in. And so the way to get you in was a really quick, fun adventure with three characters that had very basic archetype personalities. There was the wise one, there was the firebrand, and there was the newbie. And that was it. And then it was just about adventure. And I figured if it works, if people like that on that kind of a level, I can keep deepening the world as I go. But I should make sure I never go too far with exposition and exploration of place rather than story.
So when you played Dungeons & Dragons, were you a dungeon master or did you play as a participant?
I generally was a participant.
Because I hadn't read that before. Actually, it makes perfect sense now that you say that. I hadn't read it before.
So I'm terrible with rules on role-playing games. We had played a lot of different games. I mean, there was a point where in our group, every time we'd go to a hobby store and there'd be a new game, it was almost like we just did a rock, paper, scissors of whoever lost was the one who had to buy the book, or we'd go kind of around in turns because we were buying like every new role-playing book that came out, not just like the new books for Dungeons & Dragons, but when anime started hitting the scene in the early to mid-90s, and then more American things were catching on of like, hey, we need to start offering anime stuff. Somebody made an anime game called Big Eyes, Small Mouth. It was brand new. So we bought that, and we bought a couple other things, and we tried to, you know, merge some role-playing games together and lots of stuff. So we were playing so many things, I would get the rules all jumbled. I wouldn't make sense of it. I would just wait to be told what I was supposed to roll or how I was supposed to, you know, do an attribute check or whatever. And so the few times that I would try to run something, it was a disaster because the game master or the dungeon master was the one who was really supposed to know the rules backwards and forwards. So what I did was I tried doing a couple where I'd play by the rules. And inevitably I would just say, okay, start telling me about your characters instead of, you know, rolling up things. And we called them dicelesses that were like, it was just like role-playing games, but there was no system. Somebody would say, okay, well, my character goes and does this, or my character talks to the so-and-so, and then we just have the conversation. And if it was a fight, I tried my best to just make it interesting. You know, I feel like I really cut my storytelling teeth on role-playing games. Mm. Even if it's up to the dice, sometimes the dice can make a really boring story because if you get lucky and they're all successes and you wipe out the thing that was the villain too quickly, it's not as interesting. Same can be true if you really should be kind of defeating this thing and it just gets belabored because everybody's rolling, you know, ones. So I just kind of thought about the fights when I was playing this dice list that had no system for me to be able to check to see if somebody, you know, was actually hitting or not hitting or doing whatever. And I just try to make it into an interesting story. What would be interesting at this point if he hit or missed? And if he misses, what if he gets thrown by the dragon or by the villain or whatever into a wall and passes out for a couple seconds, and then it's up to the other characters. And I'll just kind of keep this going while it's still interesting and we're telling a story together. Mm.
And yet the world is the most confident. There is a lot that I love about Mouse Guard, but the world is the most confident thing about it. The world just lives, breathes, and exists. And I've never read a page that's brought me out of the world in thinking that it isn't physically there beyond the barriers of the page. So did you look at any particular worlds or dungeons that you'd done in the past in order to say, this is my world, this is how I'm seeing it, or did it all come out of your mind?
A lot of it came out of my mind. I mean, I had just kind of general things that I liked when we played role-playing games or when I read stories about, you know, is there a blacksmith in town or isn't there, or is the town more of this kind of a town? And sometimes when you play an adventure like that or you read a book and you've got just kind of a really cliche town, you go, well, what's their industry? How are they even able to exist? You've got all these people or you've got wealth here, but nobody's doing anything. You've got like a blacksmith or a furniture maker, and it's like, yeah, you're going to sell one piece of furniture a month. How are they actually staying around? You got to have people who are really labor grunts who are harvesting tons of food, or, you know, doing the stuff that everybody has to have to sustain life. So it was just kind of like that logical thing of wanting to make sure that the cities and towns in Mouseguard had that going for it. Again, because walking, talking mice on their hind legs wielding weapons is a silly premise and something that's going to get hard for, or is hard for me to get adults to believe in.
Yeah.
Not just see as a silly, like, Tom and Jerry cartoon. I had to make the setting as real as possible and the threats as real as possible. That's one of the reasons that the mice are a little bit more cartoony, a little bit more anthropomorphized, and the other animals and the backgrounds and the settings and everything I try to make as realistically as I can, because I can make that part believable and draw it enough times over and over. You know, I have to get the mice to act and emote, and I have to get them walking on their hind legs. I have to have them doing some acrobatics and put them in poses where they're fighting. And it's hard to do that with real mouse anatomy. So I have to kind of fudge some of that. And then just the repetition of drawing them over and over, they're going to get kind of refined.
Yeah.
So they have to be simplified to some degree, but the backgrounds in the world and other stuff, I think, are the thing that gives Mouse Guard some believability, some core.
Now, the fact that you spent so much time playing the role-playing games, I find that very fascinating that you did that, and the Mouse Guard series has not fallen into the quest story formula, because that would be so easy to do. Was that an intentional choice, or are you just good enough that it worked out that way?
It was unintentional. I don't think I really sat down and thought about not making it a quest, other than just maybe it's that my role playing games tended to be that way. Was that we didn't? It wasn't just, you know, here's the magic chalice. Here's an image of the magic chalice, and you have to go to the tallest tower and get it. We didn't tend to play those very often. Also because a lot of the people that I hung out with all kind of fancied themselves as either writers or writer artists or whatever. Even if someone was supposed to be GMing or DMing the game and kind of running it, all it takes is a couple of the players to almost story mutiny on them and say, no, we're going to go this way. Or my character wouldn't help the princess, because that's not really kind of how my character works. See, I've got this background of doing this, or, you know, my alignment is so, or I'm more interested in the fact that there's a bounty on my head, or, you know, whatever. And so the stories were always more character-based and interesting, where the initial goal was just kind of to get us out the door rather than taking over the general play. There's a game called Shadowrun that was Shadowrun is kind of like if you had the Blade Runner movie as a role playing game, but with orcs and trolls in there as two orcs, dwarves, and trolls and elves as races as well. And the idea of shadow running is the term shadow running is you're doing jobs that are to be done in shadows. You're doing illegal underground espionage, execution. You're being an assassin. Everything you're doing is illegal. You're doing bad stuff. And typically in our adventures, we'd end up starting working for one person. We'd have one job. You know, we'd be told, okay, you have to go steal these plans from so and so, or you have to kill so and so. And either because something we did went terribly wrong, or because we got double-crossed, we would end up working for the person that we were originally working against. And it was that kind of thing. So that's kind of how I think about storytelling, that, you know, setting out for that one goal, that one quest, and just kind of battling along a linear path, it's just not what's in me, what's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
See, and then we all thought. Talk a little bit longer, and I was taking a drink. I'm so sorry. Wow.
So, right. I want to ask a question that I ask a lot of people that I know that are artists, and mostly it's because I'm super in awe of anybody that has a capability that I utterly lack, and this is one. I know a little bit, David, of what you write. So what do you like to read?
What do I like to read? Right now, the series that I'm the most excited about is Lock and Key.
I can see why.
I came late to Lock and Key. I had heard about it, and then it was not this year's Free Comic Book Day, but last year's Free Comic Book Day. The store that I was doing a signing at, they had Joe Hill in recently to sign some books and stuff, and the owner was just telling me not only what a fantastic series it is, but how great of a guy Joe is, and he only had volume 2 there, but I bought it. And then waited till I got home, bought volume 1, and by the time I had read both of those, I was already on Amazon ordering all the rest of the hardcovers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic series. Since then I've been following Joe's prose writing as well, his novels. But for those who don't know, Lock and Key is a comic series about a house with impossible keys that the three lock children discover in their ancestral home, and the various keys can do all kinds of cool magical things, like if you use the ghost key in the ghost door and go through it, you become a ghost. There's a gender key that switches what gender you are. There's a race key that can change what ethnicity you are. There are all kinds of keys that make you a giant, keys that do all of these fantastical and impossible things. And the big plot point is there's a key called the Omega Key that a villain named Dodge wants to use to open the Omega Door. And it's up to the Locke children to try to prevent that from happening. Mm.
Vaguely unsuccessfully, as far as I've got so far. It's not going well for them, so. It's a hell of a world, actually. I can see that sitting on the shelf next to Mouse Guard, not in terms of theme or tone, but in terms of a world that is just there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very well-rounded and complete, and thanks to both the writer and the artist. I've talked with Gabe Rodriguez, who draws it, because Key House, and which is the name of the ancestral home, and the grounds around it have very specific locations and secret passages and things like that. Gabe, I guess, has a background in architecture, and so he did a model. A Google SketchUp model and some drawings to make sure that he kept Key House as accurate as he could.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. It's so believable and well fleshed out, and little background characters will return, and little nooks and crannies will show up again, where all you need is one little detail on the wall and you know, oh, we're in that room in the basement behind the stairs.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Did you Oh, sorry, Dave, I was going to ask, because and I know Archaea is a big comics publishing company. It's got an indie feel to it, Mouse Guard, to an extent. When I think of indie comics, the first one I always think about is Cerebus.
Okay, yeah.
Now, you saying about Lock and Key was the architectural basis of it. Gerhard had that as well, and he built the sets of what they were going to be drawing Cerebus in. So if he was in a room and looking around, they were looking around a set of the room.
Yeah.
Initially in models, but I think he moved on to computers later on.
I do a lot of that with practical models as well.
I was about to say, do you make your sets?
Yes, I do. There's a blog that I do once a week, which I always forget the URL of.
Hang on.
I'll look
at it. It's
davidpeterson.blogspot.com.
Cool. Yep.
I featured a lot of things on the models there, but almost every location that you've seen in Mouse Guard, I've made some aspect of it as a physical model, a practical cardboard and popsicle stick and glue model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And does that give you the time to think about it as you're making it?
Yeah, it allows me, for one, a lot of people ask why I don't do it with like a Google SketchUp or something like that. And I, frankly, I spend enough time sitting in front of a computer. Mm. So getting away from that, switching my mindset, and getting a little craft knife out and getting cardboard out and cutting and gluing and building something with my hands in 3D is a nice exercise in getting away from the regular work regimen.
Yep.
But also it helps me design something in three dimensions way faster than I could if I was drawing it. I was going to draw something, a space, and then, you know, to try to draw it in perspective as I'm drawing it, even at best, if I just nail it, if I get that one drawing right off the bat it's perfect, it's in perspective, I've only designed that room from one angle. I have no idea what the backside of the pillar looks like, or maybe how the pillar meets with the floor, or the pillar meets with the ceiling, or, you know, any of those kind of things. And you have to do lots and lots and lots of drawings to figure all those things out and to make sure that they all fit together, that it all puzzle pieces together on every axis. So instead, I can just start cutting out a piece of cardboard and then holding it up and saying, that looks about right. No, it's too tall. And then cutting it. And then gluing that piece down and saying, okay, I need to make three more of these columns, and then putting those in the corners. Okay, how would I build a ceiling, or how would I do this? And so as I'm building it, I'm designing it in a way that I couldn't do if I was drawing it.
Does that harken back to – because as I understand it, you trained as a – did you train as, or was it just one of your artistic loves, screen printing?
Never screen. I went to school for fine art and majored in printmaking.
Printmaking, yeah.
Yeah, I did do a little bit of screen printing just as part of the curriculum, but I actually hated screen printing.
Did you? Okay.
I was actually more of a woodblock and etching person. But, I mean, working with my hands. My dad's a jack of all trades. We had a workshop in the basement. We built toys together. We made house repairs together. Just all kind, basically any kind of little project, whether it was changing a room, building a room in the basement that was to be my mother's sewing room with a retractable table, or making a little model boat that could float down the neighborhood creek or anything like that. We were just always playing with wood and metal and figuring out how to glue things together. So working with my hands and doing those kind of problem solving things goes back to my childhood with my dad.
Cool. Right. So Dave, we've got two things that we always do on the show, and I'm really keen. Well, I mean, we've got loads of questions we want to ask you, and hopefully you'll get to, but there's two things that we always do on the show. One is, we never know how to introduce it. And you've suggested a good one, which is As Good As Gibbons. There, in our first issue, we were talking about, because all of us had stopped reading comics at one point in our lives, even though we loved comics. And we were trying to find out what was the rationale for that, if there was one, whether it was age or maturity or whatever. And some of it came down to the sameness and the ugliness of some of what we were buying and what was considered good and great. So in my case, ironically, because I love Image Comics now, but when Image Comics started and we had the Tom McFarlane and Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld aspects of art, that was a massive disincentive to me as, you know, then at college doing art, looking at comics, which became more and more unbelievable and unaesthetic. So we were talking about that, and we found one artist who we all agreed on who just didn't float our boat. So we now talk about the artists who are better than this artist. So the guys that we love. Now, this week he came up in conversation because outside of doing this and outside of drawing and teaching at an art or at a college, I do youth work. And I've been asked to do something youth work related in October. And one of the people organizing said, can you do something based on John Hicklinton? And I had to stop and say, I'm very interested, because this is 5 to 8 year olds. Why John Hicklinton? And she said, he was a Guildford based artist, comic artist. And I'm in Guildford, and it's a Guildford youth group. I said, yes. Have you Googled the artwork of John Hicklinton? I said, no. He said he drew Judge Dredd. So we had to stop. I had to Google it on my phone. And at that point, she said, are there any other Guildford-based artists? Because John Hicklinton was, sadly, because he passed away a couple of years ago, a hell of an artist. Really, really good. And we have spoken on the comics podcast about, from the UK perspective, 2000 AD, which was the cultural standpoint I think a lot of comic book artists look to in the UK. John Hicklinton was one of the artists for 2000 AD. His artwork was grim and gritty and grungy and painful. He was the Hellraiser, as in the film, of comic book artists. He did Nemesis. Nemesis in 2000 AD was a horned, demonic-looking alien who came to Earth to rescue us from a dictator, a human dictator. But when he drew it, Nemesis looked like a horned alien demonic creature. So we decided quite quickly. I suggested Brian Hitch because he's a fabulous comic book artist and based quite locally as well. So my pick of the week for an artist is John Hicklinton. Now, sadly, very, very sadly, he passed away a couple of years ago. He went to Switzerland. He had multiple sclerosis. He was very, very poorly. And he decided to end his life at a planned time. And it was weird because I'd known he was ill because I've been following his artwork and some of his writings. But a friend of mine posted on his Facebook to say, really sad, this has just happened. I said, well, how did you know? And he'd been to school with him. So we ended up talking all sorts of school stories and whatever. And we had a lovely time just reminiscing about somebody who I'd never met but loved the artwork from. And it was just interesting. It came up in conversation last week. In entirely the most inappropriate circumstance, because there is no way I'm going to show a 5 to 8-year-old Johnny Hicklinton's artwork, because it is fabulous, and it's fabulous for not that age group. But he is my absolute pick of the week for this week. He's an undiscovered gem. I think when we talk about Nemesis, often we'll talk about DHM, we'll talk about Kevin O'Neill, because Kevin O'Neill started it off, kicked it off. I'll talk about Brian Talbot because he brought in the steampunk. We'll occasionally talk about some of the guys that came later. But Johnny Hicklinton made it his own, and that's not a bad standpoint. So that's my artistic pick of the week. Over to you guys. Who's the artist that you would say is better than...
than a gibbon?
Than a monkey with a crayon?
Than a monkey with a crayon.
I'm going to go with Simon Roy. And
yes, definitely, yes. Oh, yes.
And I'm not surprised you like him. So, as an example, look at the early issues of Prophet, because he did the art for those. And what I love about his artwork is that he doesn't try and make everything appear photorealistic, but instead he uses the art to convey the emotions. And if you've ever seen the movie Heavy Metal, it has kind of that sort of style feel to me.
Stylistically, it's very close to Mobius.
Yes.
And that's where Heavy Metal
Flux.
Yep. Yep.
And there's just a special place in my heart for that kind of an art style. I wouldn't want to see every comic or graphic novel done that way. But when you use Simon Roy's style appropriately, it can be a very powerful element of the storytelling.
Mm. Nah, it's a plus one. I love his artwork.
And I didn't wax poetic nearly as long as you did. So, Kelly, did I stall long enough for you to come up with someone?
You totally did. I think I'm going to try and pick twice because I think I've picked one of these people already, and that's Carlos Danda, who did the first 6 issues of the new Star Wars comic from Dark Horse. And it's beautiful. And the thing that I love about what he's done is he has towed a very specific line in that the Fab Four are the stars of the Star Wars comic. It's about Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia and Han Solo and Chewbacca. And you kind of know what you're getting into because, you know, we've all spent our lives watching actual people portray these characters. It's not something like a comic book where things can sort of fluctuate over time depending on the artist that's portraying it. And so, you know, in your head, when you're watching these, reading this comic book and watching these stories unfold, you're seeing something very particular in your brain. And while the art is totally Carlos, like, there's a really nice world that's been built here, and he's not spending all of his time trying to render 1978 versions of Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford. And it's really a tricky thing to do, because you can kind of not go that direction and have it go really badly. And there have been some Star Wars comics that people didn't enjoy, and that was part of the reason was, you know, whoever was doing it wasn't overcoming the fact that people are used to seeing these things in their head. And so I'm totally picking Carlos, but I think I've picked him before. There's probably a there's probably some of that I've already done. But the other person that I want to pick, whose name escapes me at the moment, is whoever is responsible for the art behind the first 10 issues or so of Hawkeye. Because I know the cover artist is David Aja.
Yeah.
And, and he's phenomenal, but it's specifically once you open the comic and you're looking at Hawkeye and you're looking at the tracksuit Draculas and you're looking at the world that he has built, that world is beautiful, and Matt Fraction only makes it better. So that's my bonus pick for this week.
Cool.
Since Kelly got two.
Only fair.
By all means.
Yeah. One of them I kind of mentioned in the last part was Gabe Rodriguez, who draws Lock and Key. Like I said, late to the game with his work, but I just think it's beautiful. He balances being able to draw characters very real and realistically, but also not a slave to photorealism. The locations are just so rich and real. He plays with perspective in a way that's never tedious and always interesting and refreshing. And I think his stuff is wonderful. But I would say for my main pick, the person I would pick is, and it's going to come as no surprise to people who've heard me interviewed before, Jeremy Bastion. I'm biased because he's actually a friend of mine, but don't let that bias fool you. The guy's a monster when it comes to being able to do beautiful artwork. Jeremy does a book called Cursed Pirate Girl that also comes out through Archaea, and he's doing artwork that looks like 19th century engravings.
He
does them all with a brush, which once you've seen his stuff will kind of blow your mind, because it looks like it's an etching or it's done with the finest technical pen. And it's beautiful stuff. It's really rich in detail. There's only been one hardcover collection of his stuff put out, which constitutes three of his regular issues. And it's going to take him several years before he has another book ready. But that's okay, because every time you go through and reread or re-browse his book, you'll find something else in the panel that you hadn't noticed before. He hides all kinds of imagery. Sometimes he'll even hide some text. And it's just, it's equal parts like Little Nemo in Slumberland and Alice in Wonderland, and it's got some Hieronymus Bosch in there. It's surrealism, but on a classically safe level of like children's lit, the best kind of children's lit. That's nobody's doing anything like it. It's outstanding, and it stands alone as that kind of work. You look at it and you know exactly who did it. And that's what I think is really important for comic artists right now, is to be able to stand on your own, look like your own work, not try to be somebody else. And that can certainly be said of Jeremy Bastion's work.
I'm looking at some of his stuff right now, and I'm feeling really bad that I hadn't been exposed to it before now. Holy crap, this is awesome.
Well, good. That's the point of this segment of the show, right? Looking at things that deserve to be seen.
Yeah, I believe the real point of this segment in the show every week is to find more ways for me to spend my money.
That's one way of looking at it, but okay. Yeah,
we might as well just start adding a cash register noise to this portion of the program.
Yeah, pretty much. But wow, his stuff is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, and he does it all at actual size. His stuff is so finely detailed that he kind of draws at that level of detail no matter how big the piece of paper. So if it was drawn like traditional comics where they're drawn large and then reduced down, all the line fidelity and detail would kind of get washed out and get lost. Mm. So he draws all of that and inks all of that at actual size.
Okay, cool. Oh, well, that's even more amazing. Yeah. I didn't realize that. I thought it was... shrunk down.
No, that's all actual size. And like I said, with a brush, it's not a nib pen or a crow quill or a tech pen or anything like that. It's a teeny tiny little brush, and it's just gorgeous and beautiful and lush and it looks like something out of another century.
Cool. David, sorry, something you just said about size is one of the questions that I did want to ask you. Where did the 8x8 size of Mouseguard come about? And is it important? I mean, the square format is unusual. How did that come to be?
I don't think I realized how important it was until I really both got going on it and then was hired to do a couple pieces at standard size, standard comic dimensions. The square format came about because at my local comics show, the Motor City Comic Con, when I was in college, everybody and their brother was doing mini comics, and that was kind of the option for if you were going to self-publish something. When mini comics are 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper folded in half, and you get like an ash can or however you want to, you know, whatever you like calling those. And I thought, how is somebody going down the middle of the aisle going to see what I have at my table as being different? If everybody has these same kind of little square white bound books, I got to come up with some way that'll draw them over so that then they can look at the art and see what I have to offer. And I thought about different paper stock and different, maybe using color or something like that. And I ended up thinking if I used legal sized paper, which is 8.5 by 14, and you fold that in half, you get this other format. I thought that'd be interesting. And I played with some of the panel layouts on that size, and I liked it. When it came time to do Mouseguard, I decided to make the height and width the same so that it would be easy for the math. Because if you fold an 8.5 by 14 sheet, you get an 8.5 by 7 sheet of paper, and I have to do that math every time I described that sheet of paper folded in half. But with Mouseguard, it was easier being same both directions, which also helps with the math when you're doing any kind of reduction. Like, you know, I draw on 12 by 12 paper, and then it gets reduced down to 8 by 8. And so all the math becomes way easier. And I like the importance of it has to do with the way the panels flow together and also the importance of a horizontal, like, panoramic style image. Mm-hmm. I can do like a David Lean style movie, like a Lawrence of Arabia or you know, Dr. Zhivago kind of establishing shot without it just being a teeny tiny little sliver like it is on your standard comic page.
Yeah.
Now, when you're creating the art for Mouseguard, are you doing all of it traditionally, or is it being done as a combination between traditional and on your computer?
It's a combination. I do all the drawing is done by hand on paper and sketchbooks. In fact, the elements that will go together to make one panel are sometimes on several different pages of one sketchbook. I'll have to scan all those things separately. And then I kind of digitally reassemble them and composite it all, putting together a background that I might have drawn one place and then a character somewhere else, and then to make sure that the characters are the same scale when they're shaking hands, you know, kind of putting all that together, moving them around. And that's where I'll also sometimes mirror the image so I can make sure that the image looks right, because you're sometimes your brain gets trained to look at an image, and when you put it in the mirror, you can see that it's totally off. That guy's arm is way too long, or his eye is in the wrong place, or his eyes aren't symmetrical. You've drawn one of them way higher than the other, or something like that. So I'll do all those kind of little digital tweaks to my pencil drawings, print that out, put it on a light box with a sheet of the Bristol paper, the Bristol board on top, and then I ink by hand. And then it's back to the computer after I have an inked page to digitally color and letter it. So it's really a hybrid. It's both.
Mm-hmm. What software do you use to color on?
I'm using an old version of Photoshop, Photoshop 7, which is pre-CS. Okay. I guess CS is going to CS7 next, so I'm about to get lapped.
Yeah, well, actually, no. It's now just Creative Cloud and...
which is a really popular move. Yeah.
So the numbers are gone.
Why do you stay with Photoshop 7?
It has all the bells and whistles I need without getting bogged down with stuff I don't need.
Yep.
And it runs on my computer.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of change and not fixing what isn't broken. You know, you can take days, even if you're going up from like Photoshop 7 to 9 or something like that, or from CS1 to CS2, you can lose several days just figuring out all the new things or maybe where they've moved some of the menu things. Frankly, I don't usually have a day to spare for something like that. And even if I did have a day to spare, that's not how I'd want to spend it. Mm-hmm. So unless someone can prove to me that the next version of Photoshop is going to, improve the way I color or limit the time frame on how I color, you know, speed me up dramatically, I'm just not interested, especially since I'm also kind of nervous about changing things because there's a look to MouseGuard, and if I did something that changed that look in a subtle way that's not necessarily better, I'm not interested.
Do you use a Wacom pad?
I don't. Ironically, I use a mouse.
Okay.
Nope.
it's all intriguing questions. I mean, there are some lovely deforming brushes on the newer Photoshops where the brush actually moves according to the arc of where you're moving.
That's
but,
true. That's
but MouseGuard looks so beautiful, I don't touch it. Stay as you are. That's cool. So I've got a couple of questions that I'm desperate and dying to ask. One is, but there's a couple of biggies. So the first one is, we've got an avalanche towards digital. Comic shops are shutting like mad. I did read your blog about creating a comic where participants were encouraged to go to a comic shop. And I thought that was a lovely thing. And unfortunately, Guildford lost our comic shop 5 years ago. Audishop was 3 or 4 years. I mean, probably longer than that, to be honest. So we're losing comic shops, and they're all gravitating up towards London. How do you feel about the way that we're progressing more towards digital and losing analog as a result?
So I think there are several different kind of classes of comic shop. There's the kind that the guy probably also used to sell baseball cards or old pulp books as well. It's almost more like a used bookstore / antique shop or pop culture antique shop / yard sale.
Yep, I can see it. I can visualize that quite easily.
Yeah, and comics. Then you've got the kind of comic shops that are interested in it purely for collectability. They only deal in comics, but they're getting every variant issue and bagging and boarding it and that kind of thing. There's the kind of comic shop that focuses more on interactivity and does probably a lot with games rather than coming. They sell comics, but they make their weekly nut on having like magic tournaments or Yu-Gi-Oh things or, you know, big board game demo things. And really what a comic shop is going to need to evolve into, I think a lot of those places are going to in some ways become casualties of digital. And I think the comic shop that's going to stay is the comic shop that becomes the purveyor of good taste. even if all the issues go to digital and collections are kind of the only thing still being printed physical in the not too distant future, and then you go to something like a bookstore, like a Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or whatever a bookstore chain, the people who help you there have to manage the entire bookstore. They might even have a section. You know, they might be doing a specific section, but I doubt that they're going to have someone who works exclusively with comics and graphic novels. So if you go there as a noob or trying to find out about a series that you're not as familiar with, that person isn't really going to be able to give you much help beyond even kind of the vagaries that Kelly was talking about when she's looking up information and can barely find out what a long-running comic series is about. You know, it's these married couple, you know, with superpowers and her brother, and they're in space and blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't actually get into what the heart of the Fantastic Four is. So you know, somebody at a Books A Million isn't going to be able to give you the details or even tell you if it's good because they probably haven't read it. Comic shop owners who stay in business will. A good comic shop owner should be able to tell you as soon as you go in, even if you've never read a comic, by asking you a few questions about what other kind of entertainment you like, or genres you like, or authors you like, or films or movie makers, what kind of comics are for you. And that's what's going to make a comic store last, is that they're there as a service to the customer, not just a physical newsstand for product, or not just there as a collecting commodity to say, this one's going to pan out and be valuable. Frankly, the only value in comics, other than a couple, you know, couple Golden Age things that need to be kept around for historic record, Smithsonian style. Other than that, the only value to a comic is how much value you got out of it by reading it.
Yeah.
How many were printed, or if it's a variant, whatever. The only reason a variant thing is interesting is if you like the person who did the variant artwork.
Yeah.
And getting out of this collecting mode and really thinking about this as a way of digesting stories is what's important. Digital versus – I just talked a whole lot about comic shops and not about digital at all. Digital I see as being kind of what I suggested there, the replacement for all flimsy issues. It used to be that flimsy issues – you know, you hear everybody talking about when they used to be on spinner racks and they cost a dime. And you could go down to the corner drug with your pockets full of change and come home with a pile full of comics. And that was the way people digested lots and lots of different kinds of stories. You know, you talk to your parents or maybe even your grandparents about the kind of comics they read, and they were reading Westerns and Mickey Mouse and superheroes and this and that. And today, comics are expensive enough that you get into your groove and you say, this is the thing I like, and I don't know that I'm willing to try something else. Digital, that is way easier to do. You don't have to wait for the comic shop to be open. You can download it at any time. You can try one or two issues and then give it up. And if you give it up, all you have to do is delete it. I always have a practical problem when I have a couple physical issues of a comic and I'm not into it anymore. I have to pass that on. But obviously, sometimes because of the material, I have to be careful about who I pass it on to. Maybe it's too adult to just give to a kid, or maybe it's something that if I gave even to my local library, because my local library hasn't completely embraced comics, they might look at me as a weirdo if I try to give them a particular, you know, issue of something, especially when I don't even like it. I can't even say, like, oh, try this, it's really good. I'm saying, here, try this, I don't care for it. But with digital, trying things out should be way easier. You can bundle things digitally in ways that you never could practically in print. You know, you'll have a series that maybe starts to be a breakout hit, and they'll have that awkward, you know, issue one has sold out and issue two is coming out next week, and now they have to reprint issue one, but it looks like issue two is about to sell out. So then they do the bumper issue that's one and two, but they only print 4,000 of them or whatever. And it starts to become confusing about what you should buy and when, because they're just trying to get the content out to the people. So you can have individual issues in digital. You can have issues bundled by twos. You can have issues bundled by threes. You can do collections. You can do whole collections, like with Bone. You could have a buy in one purchase click where you get all of Bone.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just digital it's a digital packaging method in ways that just isn't practical for a store to stock or for publishers to print. So I think in terms of trying to get more people to digest stories, digital is going to be really important. And I don't say that by undervaluing print at all. I love physical objects. I think the books, the collections of comics that are going to be printed are going to have to really have a focus on the books being art objects in and of themselves. They're going to have nice end papers. They're going to have to think about the paper quality. They're going to have to think about extras. They're going to have to think about the binding. I pretty much only buy hardcover collections these days. Because it's just easier to cuddle up in a big chair on a Sunday afternoon and read through it and not feel like I'm breaking the spine or have to sit at a table or you know have the right posture to read a book or something like that. And then the stores that will survive are the ones that are going to either – or that are already doing the right thing or the people who are putting in the effort to try to do the right thing and interact with customers and be able to recommend the right kind of stuff and have events and be dealing with humans rather than collectibles.
Are you optimistic on their behalf?
Yeah, I think it's a – there's a big game of chicken right now that's happening with publishers and retailers and Diamond and the audience. That's why digital issues are pretty much the same price as the stuff that's coming out in print. Hypothetically, they should be, you know, ridiculously cheaper.
That, I tell you what, that thoroughly irritates me because if you take out paper cost and you take out transport and logistics, those are the two-thirds of the cover price of a comic.
Yeah.
And I've got no issue with Marvel and DC making, well, you know, all of the comic companies making money, but they were the two big guys to get into digital. But it irritates me, it irks me that they set a price point, which was a price point they had to do because of the cost of artwork and writers and colorists and transportation, but they don't need to do it, and they priced it so high. I wonder if that still creates a barrier for comic purchases for people who are not comic book buyers.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the reason is, and in some ways it's a good reason, is that the retailers would all instantly go out of business. You wouldn't have
That's
a transition.
True. Yes, true.
You'd just have a collapse. You'd have a collapse, and everybody would go out of business because everybody could buy everything digitally. And so until you start having the natural attrition of bad stores or stores that aren't good enough to hack it these days going under. And that's not to say that every store that's going under wasn't good enough to hack it. I feel for stores on their razor thin budgets trying to convince old readers to come back and new readers to come in. It's an uphill battle, even if you're doing everything right. But the digital just, it can spell certain death for them until you are kind of boiled down to only good shops and shops doing what they're supposed to be doing and everything else in the model kind of working as it should. And until that kind of game of chicken gets resolved of who's going to blink first, who's going to collapse first, is Diamond going to collapse because there are enough delinquent stores, are stores going to collapse first? Who's going to actually go under? Digital's kind of going to float off to the side as almost like an interesting science experiment.
Yeah.
Where it's working, it's picking up speed. I mean, I can tell you from my own statements as a creator from Arkea, the digital sales have increased dramatically in the last year. I mean, dramatically. And so that's interesting, but what the real future is going to be is going to have to wait until there's the freedom to set the price differently. And in terms of it not being accessible to new readers, every other music kind of battle and app battle already determined that pretty much the price, the magic number price is 99 cents.
Yeah. Yep.
The consumers feel that 99 cents isn't real money, and so they're willing to spend 99 cents 5 to 10 times over, but they won't buy a $2 thing.
Yeah. Which brings me to, I'll tell you what, I'm cutting questions left, right, and center. Can I Oh, sorry, Kelly. Can I just ask one other question?
Please. Well, let me just jump in and do the sponsor bit, because probably have to go. So this podcast, just like everything else that's on the British Tech Network, is brought to you by UK2.net. They presumably happily pick up the cost of bandwidth for all the shows and all the hosting of all the stuff that we do here on the British Tech Network. And that is not an insignificant amount. This isn't some guy with a server in the garage and that's all it takes. It's way, way more than that. And they've been with us almost the entire time that the British Tech Network has been a network. And they're going to continue in the foreseeable future. So if you go to britishtechnetwork.com/sponsors, on the sponsors page, you can click through to UK2, and there are a number of discount codes. You can get 50% off your first month of a VPN. You can get some other free deals. You can get free DNS. You can get 20% off your domain. You can get all kinds of great stuff through them if you just go to our website, britishtechnetwork.com/sponsors, and then from there, you can head over to uk2.net. And if you do go there, even if you don't use any of the sponsor codes, do let UK2 know that we are who sent you, because it's important for them to know that the word is getting out and that we're helping to spread it. So that's definitely what I would pick. That would definitely be the way to go, is make sure that if you hear about them from us and you do go sign up for something from them, make sure that they know about that as well. Awesome. And that was it. You can ask as many questions as you want now.
Oh, I'll tell you what, last one from me. But it's the one that interests me the most. So far, and Dave, by all means, correct me if you're wrong, because I've not played the role-playing game. I'm aware of the fact I've seen the blog, but not read it every single week. The animals that we've met so far, apart from the mice, mm-hmm. have all been non-verbal. They've been very animalistic. And haven't spoken, apart from the crow caws and the snake hisses, except for all of the animals that are related to weasels. So I think we've had the fishers. Are they the otters?
Fishers are they're just a species of weasel.
Okay, I took them as otters. I thought that, and you got the ferrets are all related to weasels. Yep. They're the only other guys who've got language.
Hares. The hares spoke.
Oh, of course it did, yeah.
So the way I see it is, go ahead with your question, I assume. I was kind of picking the gun on what the question was, but go for it.
Well, I love it when you get a non-verbal animal. The crabs felt like a fantastic threat, mm-hmm. and the snake. And I love it when these guys pop up, the bees and whatever, because they're animals within the world that mice are not necessarily. They're humanized animals to an extent. Whose point of view are we going to see the weasel war from? Are the weasels definitely the bad guys, or are they as culturally advanced within the world that they're living in as the mice are?
So the weasel war stuff will definitely be... it'll be told... Everything's going to be told from the point of view of the mice. Well, sort of. That's actually not entirely true. Okay. Yeah, that's a hard one to answer. I think Weasel War will be the first time that there will be parts of the story being shown to the reader where a mouse isn't present to have witnessed it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think... has been the case in all of my mouse stories, that there's always a mouse there kind of witnessing it, other than maybe in a couple flashbacks where a character is describing to a mouse something that happened in the past.
But that would still be from a mouse perspective.
Yeah, because the mouse is the one witnessing the telling of that flashback. So there will be parts where it'll be just weasels. And ferrets and minks and, you know, all the kind of weasel kin. Mm. But beyond that, I don't really want to go into any plot points of weasel war.
No. Yep.
I actually haven't figured out a way to describe what happens without basically blowing the ending. When you start to do press for things, like when Black Axe was starting to come out, I had a hard time. I had to kind of figure out a way to describe Black Axe without... blowing point of the whole series, which is some of the reveals of the secrets.
Yeah.
and major plot points. So I haven't done my homework on how to describe Weasel War that way. But yeah, the way I see the different species in Mouse Guard is that everything's being told from the perspective of a mouse. And we as humans are supposed to be sympathetic and on the same level as the mouse in this story. So to the mice, these other things are predators. And even when they speak, they're not really important enough to spend time with or to have conversations with. I figure the further away on kind of like a species chart you get away from a mouse, the less of the language the mouse would understand. So when you get up to like the hares, I had them with accents. Because even though they're still mammals and they're small and they're kind of in that rodentia family, you're starting to get to the point where you've got something that speaks English but has an accent. Then you get further away and say if something like a fox had a chance to speak or maybe something in between like a fox and a hare, something size-wise. I'm not coming up with a good example, but they might be able to speak to it the way someone who speaks German but knows a few English words and can fake some of it. Like that's how the mice would hear that particular species of animal until you get far enough away that you get into things that aren't even mammals, like crabs and snakes and insects and birds, and they just make sounds. And so to the mice, they're these either ferocious and terrible or stupid insects or interesting birds or whatever, but they're just like species. They're like real animals, the way we look at animals. But I see it as being more like how when white man first encountered the Native Americans, white man saw them as ignorant savages, as practically beast. They didn't wear clothes, and they lived in the skins of animals, like teepees and wigwams. They were these uncivilized things that had no culture, and they were ignorant in the wider European way of understanding the world, which clearly had to be the most important way because it was Europeans deciding that. That's kind of how I see the mouse culture. That they look at a snake and they go, like, what a terrible beast. It doesn't even speak English and it's not wearing clothes. But I think that every animal in Mouse Guard has sentient traits and has some kind of culture, some kind of lifestyle, some kind of language. All of that stuff exists. It's just because we're getting it from the mouse's point of view, it doesn't show up.
Which is what interests me, because I love the dialogue between the mice and the ferrets, for example, because they were on an equal level. The Ferret King was putting a deal in the Black Axe. I don't want to say anything. I don't know how much equals a spoiler or not. But I love the fact that each were talking to each other equally. That's why I'm really, really psyched about the Weasel War. Obviously, because we've spoken about it a number of times in the graphic novels and story. But because we're finally at a place, not finally at a place, but we're at a place where the mice are up against some thing that is on an equal footing educationally, emotionally, with their own culture.
Some of that was just for ease of story. I wanted to make sure that the cultures seemed different, which is why I went for different kinds of architecture and clothing to make the weasels and ferrets seem very foreign to the mouse society. But then some of that's just for ease of story. If I had them feeling too foreign and had them using very different language and very different educational levels or whatever, it would just be too hard to ever get them kind of having the interactions that are important, the bits that are important.
And when is the Weasel War? I know you said you're working on a different project prior to that. You've been talking in terms of years. Yeah. Oh, and then it went quiet.
Uh-oh. Are we losing everyone?
I'm still here. I don't know. Who'd we lose?
I think we lost David.
That's so sad.
Oh, no.
Maybe his wife blocking it. That what? I tell you what. I hope we get him back. But that was fabulous. I want to sit down and read them all over again.
I was going to just bail. Like, I've done my sponsor piece. I'm going to have to hang up. You guys just go. Because you can basically go until Jeff runs out of hard drive.
Okay. Right, or until I have to do my next podcast.
I think point we can go on forever, but I don't think UK2 would be happy to do X amount of terabytes just for the one show. I think you and Mike have things to say. It's probably a good time to wrap up, and we'll send very fond regards to David. I hope he will come back in, and we can edit in a goodbye. I tell you what, Mouse Guard is. I've been horribly fanboyish all the way through. I've been asked a number of times to organise graphic novels for school libraries and college libraries and whatever. Mouse Guard is always way high up on the list.
Mm-hmm.
As being something that is a graphic novel that should be in every school library. Full stop.
Yes.
It's just so good. Every age group can pick it up. Every age group can read it. And it's it's a graphic novel for all the right reasons.
I think what I enjoy about it is that it's also, like I said, it looks very different than a lot of sort of comic style, you know, halftone kinds of things. And you know, the world is built and you just sort of walk in and take a look around while you're there. And it's really, really great because it is different. And it's a different size, you know, it's a different approach to the art. It's different in that it's self-contained in, you know, there's definite story arcs that you get in each thing. It's not like we were talking about, you know, you don't have to come in on episode 220 of the Fantastic Four and, you know, not have any idea what's happening. Like these are all sort of encapsulated and it's nice to be able to sit down and read a story that way. That's pretty awesome. So that's one of the things that I like the best about it. And I think for those who are playing along at home and waiting for us to pick, I think in case you hadn't noticed, we've basically all picked Mouse Guard this week.
That's fair enough. Yep.
Yeah. Let's get that. Yeah, we'll
so that's why we're not having that conversation this week is because...
What should Alex read? He should read Mouse Guard.
There you go.
We've kind of had that conversation already with we picked it and we love David and I believe we have him back.
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, we totally do have David back. So we're going to go ahead and say goodbye for this week. Or perhaps this week and next we may end up splitting this episode in half.
We'll find out. And
this may end up being a very special two-parter issue of the comic
Double
podcast.
Sound.
Which would be awesome. You know, we'll have, like, every 10 issues, we'll have to do the annual, you know, and then we can all take a week off.
With the foil cover, of course.
And the foil variant cover. So I absolutely want to extend all of our thanks and gratitude to our first official guest, David Peterson.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you so much. For taking the time to hang out with us, because it was a not insignificant amount of time. And also, this is a shameless plug section, so tell us where people can find you and where they can find your books.
You can find my books wherever good comics or books are sold. You can get them from Amazon and Barnes & Noble if you prefer to have your books shipped. I think you can even buy them directly from Arkea through their website. You can find me most easily either on Facebook as David Peterson, or on Twitter. I'm at MouseGuard. I do a weekly blog post every Tuesday at davidpeterson.blogspot.com. And, yeah, that's the way to find me.
Excellent. And Paul?
You can find me on the interwebs at Kercal, kercal.co.uk.
And Jeff?
Well, you can find me at macobserver.com. You can find me here on like most of the podcasts, just
around the network.
Yeah, around the network. You can find me on Twitter and app.net. I'm JGam at both places. You can also find me at my personal blog, Fresh Brewed Tales, where I talk about the ridiculous things I see in coffee shops.
Occasionally and illustrated to bring it back around to being the comic show.
That's true. Occasionally I hand draw what I see instead of sneaking photos. And and then Apple Context Machine, we have communicators, lots of podcasts. Google me, you can find me.
Jeff's not hard to find, I promise.
And Kelly, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter and app.net as Verso. You can occasionally find me hosting the Tuwa Talk cast over at tuaw.com, where the unofficial Apple weblog talks about the news of the week. You can definitely find me each and every week on the Angry Mac Bastards podcast. That one does have an explicit tag. It's definitely not family entertainment. And you can also find me, I already said Twitter and app.net, so you can also find me elsewhere on this very network. Keep your ears peeled, and it's pretty easy to tell when I've left my mark on one of the other shows. So, Jeff and I are actually about to start our own podcast where we keep track of all the other podcasts we're doing. So
that'll be a full-time job, I'm thinking.
Pretty much,
this week in Jeff and Kelly. No, that needs a different wording.
Podcast Index.
That's exactly what it is. The Jeff and Kelly Podcast Index.
I love it.
That's awesome. David is full of titles. That's fantastic. I love it.
The man of words. David, thank you very, very much. This has been an absolute thrill.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate it.
And we're so pleased you were able to be our first official guest.
Yep.
And if anyone has any suggestions for future guests, we're more than happy to take them, but if you also have a way for us to contact someone who may be good as an official guest, that's also a very, very excellent piece of information we would like to get. As we've determined, you can find any of us on all the interwebs, so just track one of us down, and we're more than happy to take your pitch. So I think that's going to do it for this issue, which may or may not be two parts at an hour 45 minutes. And
next issue, hopefully the return of DHM.
Here's the hoping. Yes. We don't want to have to get a stand-in.
No.
We need. Yeah. Like a new Darren on Bewitched. We're not looking to do that. Although, if David wanted to join us again next week, I'm pretty sure there's no possible way we'd turn that down.
He'd end up with another two-parter.
You know, that
was me behind. I just
say that like it's a bad thing.
No, it's not a bad thing at all.
Not a bit. So we'll go ahead and wrap it up for this week. This has been the Comic Podcast. And for David Peterson, Jeff Gamet, Paul Kirkle, and myself, Kelly Gamont, I wish you all a wonderful, wonderful week.
Thanks for listening.